Welcome to this podcast series on inclusion and education from the University of Leeds. Our research brings together experts in education, childhood and youth studies with an aim to promote equality across family, education, policy, legal and community settings. To read more about our work, please visit the School of Education website. You can find this link and others discussed during the podcast in the programme description.
Hello, my name is Luke McFarlane and I am a PGR in the School of Education. For this week's episode, we have two guests, if you would like to introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Dr. Matt Homer from the School of Education. I'm an associate professor in the school.
My name is Rachel Matheson. I am a research fellow in the School of Education.
So you have recently published a piece of research.
So I was the PI, the principal investigator on this three-year project, looking at how this new post-16 maths qualification was going in its early stages in England. I mean, there's so much more we can say about this. Rachel, do you want to say something?
This project was a three-year project funded by the Nuffield Foundation. It was a mixed methods project. So we were collecting data from across the country, numerical data, statistical data related to students. But we also did a lot of qualitative work with some case study institutions.
Your study was talking about core math. So how does core mathematics differ as an A-level from a traditional A-level math?
In terms of policy, the reason core maths was introduced was post-16 maths participation rates in England are seen as very low compared to other countries. So the government over the last 10 years have become aware of this problem. So core maths was introduced to sort of fill the gap between the more academic kind of maths that's in A-level maths and GCSE to sort of provide a more useful applied qualification that students who weren't really, really into maths for its own sake might choose to study, to support their other studies, but also to support their employment prospects and their kind of more general skills in life.
There has been concern about the level of numeracy or the level of mathematical ability or quantitative ability in undergraduates and in recent entrants to employment and generally across society. A lot of adults actually don't function very well in terms of their numeracy. And so this very widespread concern from many different stakeholders led to the introduction of this qualification, which is not an A-level. It's what's called a level 3 certificate. And it's equivalent to roughly half an A-level in terms of the time you spend studying it. So you could do it over 1 year in the sixth form, or you could do it sort of long and thin over 2 years in the sixth form, spending just a couple of hours a week studying it. So really, it's more of a supportive qualification or a supportive course which enables you to transfer what you know and what you can do between that qualification and other things. So that might be between core maths and other A-levels, such as psychology, chemistry, biology, which use quantitative skills, or between the course and your own life. And that aspect of it is what we found was the most useful. Students and staff all said that this was the most useful thing about core maths, was its applications. It's all about applying mathematics skills and knowledge to other contexts, which might be real life contexts, employment contexts, or other study contexts.
Let me just add, I think it's important for listeners to realise how kind of innovative and how big this introduction of this new qualification was in policy terms. Now, whether the policy has been a success or not, we will probably get on to. But, you know, creating a new qualification, maths is seen as quite a prestigious subject, but this is kind of a maths for all almost. It potentially, the numbers of students who could be doing this qualification is absolutely huge. The government, Michael Gove, back in 2011, when he was Education Secretary, you know, maths to 18 for all. Now, England's nowhere near that. Core maths was hopefully designed to sort of at least address that problem in part. I mean, just to join this up a bit, the reason why maths is so seen as so important is basically because of the economic argument that the workforce, if they can up their maths skills, will become a more productive country. That's the government's key concern, I think. I mean, they might also say that, you know, if people have better maths skills, they might well have better lives more generally. And understanding all the data that's around us and making better decisions, both personally and other ways.
In your report, I was reading from a teaching aspect. Teachers also are enjoying core math as something to teach because it kind of gives a greater level of flexibility compared to like traditional A-level math.
So teachers generally were really, really enthusiastic about core math. They like the freedom of it, the fact that you can start a lesson with a simple premise or a simple question or a fact, and then you let the lesson just go where it wants to go. And teachers have really enjoyed that flexibility because they have found a real contrast between that and other courses like the A-level or even GCSE, where there's so much content in the course that they find themselves driving through the content, trying to cram everything in before it gets to the assessment point, the examination point. 20% of core maths is the content from GCSE. So in terms of content, it's quite light. It's more about how you apply that and what you do with problem solving and exploratory work in the lessons. So that's a real breath of fresh air for teachers. And we had a lot of comments from teachers saying things like, yeah, I went on the training for this, but I couldn't teach it because my timetable was already full. But I'm really jealous of the person who did get to teach it because I really wanted to do it. And other teachers who were saying it was actually the highlight of their week was the core maths lesson. You know, we had more than one teacher who said that to us. They loved the lesson, literally the highlight of their week. So it's gone down really, really well with teachers. And they can also see the links between what they do in the lessons and the students' enjoyment because they can use it outside of those lessons.
It's important to realise the potential for a different kind of maths lesson with core maths because you're not, as Rachel's kind of alluded to, you're not focused necessarily on loads of extra content. You're more focused on embedding the maths in sort of real world contexts, and then how do you bring your mathematical skills to solve the problems? What assumptions do you need to make? What other data might you need to look up? And so there is a real opportunity there, certainly in the spirit of the original development of the qualification, to have really different activities in maths classes. The extent to which that's actually happening is patchy, I think, and probably we found that. But there was certainly a lot of enthusiasm. But for teachers, you know, it's easy to not underestimate. It's hard for them to change their practice if they're used to this other approach without, you know, some sort of professional development and support. And some teachers, I mean, I was I'm a mathematician by training, and I loved all the more geeky abstract maths. So whether I'd be making a good core maths teacher is very much an open question, I think.
Can core maths be more inclusive than a traditional A-level math?
Yeah, 100%. The policy aspiration is maths to 18 for pretty much everyone. Now, before the introduction of core maths, there wasn't any other real maths. Well, there were other smaller qualifications, but those hadn't really taken off. A-level itself is actually very, very exclusive. So that, you know, the GCSE grade that you have to get is extremely high, and there's some tentative evidence it's getting even higher, because schools are very much, well, as I understand it, fixated on ensuring very, you know, top grades, rather than accepting doing an A-level maths and getting a D or an E is still okay. You know, that's not the world we're living in at the moment, unfortunately. In terms of inclusion, core maths is designed for anyone who's got basically a standard pass at GCSE, grade 4 or perhaps 5, but any grade at GCSE that's a pass. You know, again, there's interesting questions around the enactment and whether that's always the case in all colleges.
I was going to talk a little bit about the contrast between A-level maths and core maths, and that we think it's an unhelpful contrast. And we think that even students who are doing A-level maths could also helpfully do core maths, because essentially it's different. Skills that you're developing are very, very different. So there's a discourse currently running, or there has been a discourse, about core maths being the maths that you can do if you can't get onto the A-level maths course. And we think that that's unhelpful. We think that actually it's much broader than that, and core maths is helpful to everybody. So if you were doing A-level maths, as we were saying earlier, that's far more sort of abstract, and you have to have very high grades at GCSE to be able to get onto A-level courses. But you could still do core maths as well, because it's very, very different.
You did this research over a three-year period. What came across as the real challenges in conducting this?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about the sort of quantitative side, and then maybe Rachel can talk about the case study side. So, yeah, we just to give you a quick overview, essentially we had three or four big data strands. There were case study institutions doing core maths. There was national data at the student level that we used, national pupil database. So that was quantitative stuff. We did a survey of teachers, and then there were various other bits of data as well. But the main challenge for me, as for the quantitative national data, was there's been a move towards much more kind of data security, and the Department for Education are really careful about that, which means access to these really amazing data sets is much more challenging, and you basically don't get given the data. You have to access the data remotely. So there are all sorts of hurdles and barriers that you have to overcome. And even when you get the data, it's a completely different experience. And I would be honest, and I've talked to other academics about this who also work with this national data, who have basically said the barriers are so difficult that you'd think twice about doing it in another project, which is a real shame. So there's an interesting tension there between the kind of ethical thing about protecting data, but then the ethical issue of the research not being done. So that was the main challenge for me.
I was responsible for finding case study institutions, and then for maintaining the links with the case study institutions, and for actually going out there and doing the field work. So the first challenge really is finding schools and colleges that are the sort of case studies that you want, but also that are willing to take part in the research. And this is a massive challenge for anybody who wants to develop case study research in education, because you're basically asking people who are extremely busy already, quite stressed, working in very pressurized situations, to give up some of their time and energy and thought to be part of your project. So that can take a long time. Thankfully, we managed to recruit 13 institutions. So that was schools and colleges. FE colleges, sixth form colleges, in various parts of the country. And we visited them on three separate occasions, because part of the study was wanting to see how things changed over time or developed over time. So I went to each of the institutions three times. It would have been the autumn of 2017. Is that right, Matt?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And then again, a year later, in the summer of 2019. So again, the challenges of doing a longitudinal study are, can you find the same people when you go back? Because you want to see how things have developed. So can you revisit the same situation or the same people? And that's a challenge in itself. So from the point of view of trying to find pupils who were doing core maths, I remember going into several schools and colleges at the start of the year, talking to various year 12s, for example, and getting them to do a little questionnaire that we had for them, and then going back in at the end of the year to try and find how those students had got on, and to get them to do the same questionnaire again so that we could compare their responses. And half of them weren't there, just because they had an exam on that day, or they were out on work experience on that day, or they just weren't in school on that day. So that's a methodological challenge, is trying to find the same people on two occasions.
No, I was just going to say, I think I've just been while you've been talking, and one of the points I think it'd be really important to emphasise is the complexity of the post-16 kind of landscape in England in education. So many different types of colleges, so many different curricula, so many different types of students. And so when you're doing a kind of national project where we're trying to get a sense of the national picture, and okay, the case study is not supposed to generalize maybe, but that really is a challenge to get the rich qualitative data that kind of speaks to the wider picture. So, you know, it was really interesting at the beginning. We had an advisory board and we were asking people, you know, could they recommend maybe institutions for us, good candidates, but they would, you know, recommend institutions with massive uptake of core maths that weren't really by any stretch of the imagination typical of the bigger picture. They wanted us to sort of showcase the success and where it was going really well, but the purpose of the project was to see whether that was true everywhere. So there was a big tension there.
That's really important to emphasize, that we tried to find, and we think we did find, case studies that weren't sort of a high profile. We dug really deeply and found schools and colleges that were sort of off the beaten track, and they might have had two core maths students, for example. But we wanted to see how everybody was experiencing this. And so part of what was interesting about our project was the fact that I think four or five of the institutions who we started out with actually dropped core maths during the course of the project. You know, and that in itself was reflecting the national picture. So it was really important to see these institutions as not just, you know, oh, hey, this is how we've made a real success of core maths, but you know, the reality is a lot of institutions were really struggling with it. So, and the other thing, to go back to the methodological issues, was that we lost two of our case studies. We lost one of our case studies within 12 months, and then we lost another one at the end of the second year of the project. So we just weren't able to go back in there. And again, this is a function of people being really very busy, very pressurized. Our initial contact at those schools had moved on, and we couldn't actually access the school again because it was somebody else who we were trying to communicate with, for example. So really important methodological issues there that came up in the project. So it highlighted how important it was to kind of over-recruit at the beginning, because you've got to prepare yourselves for the fact that you might get dropout.
Okay, one final question, and we've got this from one of our postgraduate researchers, April. So she wants to ask, could Matt and Rachel provide details about how they developed productive interviews and how they analysed the data?
That's a really, really good question. I want to just say that I'm really nosy, but that's not good enough, is it? You need to have a good knowledge of what might come up. So good preparation. You know, what are the appropriate questions to ask? So do a good literature search, know your subject, know the sorts of things that you need to cover. You know, what do I need to ask questions about? Because collecting data is all about getting useful information, isn't it? You know, it's no good going into an interview and the person talking about, you know, what they're going to have for tea that night or something, and you come away with a conversation that's no use whatsoever. You need to know the topics and the content of what you want to talk about. However, that must be balance with the ability to follow the conversation as it develops. And that's a really important skill for people who are learning how to do interviews, is to be able to follow the conversation, listen carefully to what your interviewee is telling you, and then ask follow-up questions, because that provides really rich data. You are digging further and further into what's important to that interviewee, and then the ability to steer the conversation back if you need to come back to a topic that you feel you haven't covered. So it's a mixture of having a sheet of paper in front of you and knowing what questions and what topics you want to cover, but also that having the flexibility to follow the conversation and gradually dig deeper and deeper. And partly that digging deeper and deeper is a way of engaging your participants, because you want your interviewee to talk. You want them to talk about things that are important to them. So having the ability to listen and be flexible and be interested in that is a really important skill for an interviewer. Did you want to say something about analysis as well? In terms of analysis, we used NVivo to do the analysis, to code up the interview data.
Thank you for listening. For more information about our work, please visit the School of Education website. If you have any questions about our research, or if you would like to study with us at the University of Leeds, you can contact the Research Centre Director, Professor Michaelis Kontopodis, for further details. You will find all relevant links and contact details in the programme description.